Okay, gang, welcome back. We start another week, March the 8th, the second week of the month of March, 2010. And we have one heck of a program for you tonight. This is a world exclusive, and I am very gratefully thankful for two gentlemen who have made this program possible tonight, and of course the prime gentleman who will be with us in just a few minutes to tell his personal story and reminiscences of an extraordinary event that he lived a piece of history that has been commemorated in a book written by Ruben Uriarte and Noe Torres. The book is an extraordinary account. It is called The Other Roswell, UFO Crash on the Texas-Mexico Border. Again, Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte are the two authors. The story has to do with the events surrounding the crash of a UFO and a U.S. Air Force Reserve pilot, Colonel Robert A. Willingham, U.S. Air Force Reserve, now retired, flying an F-86. He saw the UFO, he chased it, he watched it crash into the ground and landed his jet and actually drove back to the crash site. And what's an amazing story. Let's find out if everybody's online now. Ruben, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm online here.
Welcome back. It's good to talk to you again.
Always there, Jeff.
Thank you. Ruben is the Northern California State Director of the Mutual UFO Network. And is Noe with us? Noe, are you there?
Yes, Jeff. I'm hoping that you all can hear me fine. I'm calling from South Texas, and I'm very delighted to be on tonight.
Good, Noe. We hear you just fine. Noe Torres, the co-author of the book The Other Roswell with Ruben Uriarte. This is, again, a world exclusive. For the first time ever, Colonel Robert B. Willingham, U.S. Air Force Reserve retired, is going to tell his story live on radio. The Other Roswell has the book version of the Colonel's story, which is absolutely riveting reading, but we're going to actually hear the man himself tonight. Ruben, when did you first come across this story?
Well, both Noe and I have been working on our first research, which was Mexico's Roswell, the crash in Coyame, Chihuahua, Mexico.
Right.
And one of the things that we kept coming across was a reference to other UFO crashes along the border. And Noe had gotten in touch with Dr. Bruce McAbee to find out more about this one particular event that occurred close to Del Rio, Texas. And from that, we were very, very fortunate, Jeff, to get in contact with Colonel Willingham. We consider him as one of America's true authentic heroes, as you will be here shortly. So he shared with us his unique experiences, and we're very, very happy that we were able to publish his story in the book, and the fact that he's still around to share his experience.
Right. Noe, the book itself, The Other Roswell, available on your website, you and Ruben's website, roswellbooks.com, which is available by simply clicking on either Ruben or Noe's names. You'll go right there. I would urge all of you to get the book. In fact, all three of their books are extraordinary. To put it mildly, these are major contributions to the research of ET and UFO visitation to this planet, which goes on all the time. Let me just read, if I might, a little bit of the description of the book to help and get a comment from Noe, and then we'll meet the Colonel himself. On a clear spring day in 1955, an Air Force reservist, Robert Willingham, was piloting an F-86 fighter jet across West Texas, when he saw an intensely bright UFO streak past his aircraft at over 2,000 miles an hour, and then crash land along the banks of the Rio Grande River, where he later found smoldering, twisted wreckage that convinced him the object was not of this earth. Noe, tell us a little bit about your involvement in the book, when you first started with it, working with Ruben on this story.
It was a very exciting development for us, Jeff. We were working, as Ruben said, on our first book, and then we heard bits and pieces of this story about something else that had happened back in the 1950s. I contacted Dr. Bruce McAbee, and he told me that he had just received a videotape of Colonel Willingham speaking to a reporter from a Dallas, Texas television station.
Mm-hmm.
So he had been interviewed about his incident in 1999, as it turns out, and Dr. McAbee had the videotape of that, which he shared with us. So then it was a matter of tracing him down. We contacted the Dallas TV station, and they gave us a lead as to where Colonel Willingham resided, which was near Wichita Falls. And Ruben and I actually went out to visit with him. We've been out there a couple of times. We sat in his living room and talked to him. We were very impressed by his story, his vivid memories of what happened that day. Certainly a life-changing experience that he underwent that really impacted the rest of his life. So after hearing his remarkable story, which your listeners are about to hear in just a few moments, after hearing that, we became convinced that this gentleman lived through an experience such as few other human beings have ever known.
Indeed. And the number of U.S. Air Force or other military aviators who have come forward to tell their story is, well, a handful. Very, very few people have the courage. And I think this is evidence of Colonel Robert Willingham's understanding that there are bigger things on this planet than the military, and even though he came from a different age when you were told to do something, you did it in the military, he has very bravely and heroically come forward to tell his story to both Noe and Ruben, and he's going to share that with us tonight. Let's find out if Colonel Robert B. Willingham is online right now. Are you there, Colonel?
Yes, sir.
Well, sir, thank you very much for being here with us tonight. I am very much honored, as are all of our listeners, and we are very grateful for you for being here tonight.
Well, my two buddies you got there with you, and I appreciate y'all inviting me to be with you.
Well, it's...
And I like to talk to them. They're nice people.
They're as nice as they get. You got that one right, sir. Let me ask you a question, Colonel. At what point in your life did you decide to come forward with this story? And prior to that, how were you instructed in the past not to talk about this event? Then we'll go into the event itself.
Well, I got the first part of that back in about 61. About then, to get on the program to talk about these crashes they're having around everywhere. But I'd been working on it since 1947. And we'd travel around and look at these crashes and see if we could figure out what they were and what they weren't. And I had another guy with me, a little heavyset guy that's passed away. He's the one that started me on this stuff. And he passed on here about 10 years ago.
And, Colonel, excuse me. When you say you've been involved with this since back in 1947, was that as a military aviator or is it a private citizen doing research into these things?
Well, that was private citizens doing that.
I see. All right.
Yeah.
So even before you were flying on the day in question in 1955, you had an interest in the UFO issue and had been researching it since 47. 47, of course, is the year of Roswell. Would that have been your first major case,
sir,
that you worked on?
No, that wasn't the first one I was on. The first one I was on right south of Elmira, New York.
When you say the first one you were on, who put you on it? This friend of yours who passed on 10 years ago?
Yes, sure was.
So just the two of you were investigating these things?
Right.
That's fascinating.
Ask your friend there. He knows his name.
All right. We'll get there. Hang on, Colonel, if you would. We have to pause just for a couple of minutes. We'll come right back. Talking with Colonel Robert B. Willingham in a world exclusive here. He is going to tell his story of what happened in 1955. But very interestingly, he already had a very solid interest in researching the idea of UFO crashes and that they were real. And he had been involved with it since 1947, which is 8 years before the event you're going to hear described in just a few minutes. My guests are Noe Torres and Rupert Uriarte, and Ruben and I and Noe will be right back with the Colonel in just a couple minutes. Okay, welcome back. Jeff Rentz with Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte and Colonel Willingham, the man of the hour. All right, Colonel Willingham, another question or two, just if I may, about the other crashes you were investigating.
Okay.
Network, if you could just take Ruben and Noe down for a couple of minutes, I think it'll clear up the line just a little bit so we have a little crisper. There we go. The other crash cases you were investigating from 1947 on, as you and your friend, private citizens, what did you find out? What did you learn? What did you discover about them? And how many cases were there between 1947 and 55, approximately, that you were involved with, again, as private citizens?
Well, he would work all week on it, but I was having to fly most of the time. And different places. I was flying pipelines and coastlines and what have you.
Uh-huh.
And we'd go out on the weekend and look at these places that he found where they had crashed. Sometimes it wasn't nothing but scrap pieces of tin or maybe a little framework and first one thing another. But they all look like something would come out of the universe, you know, that we don't know nothing about.
So you were actually fairly well familiar with this whole concept of UFOs crashing beforehand. Now, I might ask the obvious question, how did your friend come to find knowledge about the locations of these crashes?
Well, He did that. He worked at the university up there in Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And he was getting all kinds of it because they had a contract to test these things to make sure that they were happening and what it was. I never did hear any of them say what they were. But I read a lot about what they had found and different chemicals and metal content and different things like that, but that's about all.
So
I never did. Go ahead.
No, sir, you go ahead, please.
Well, anyway, we worked New York. We had two in New York, one mm-hmm. up at... in that area, and right south of New York City, about 8 miles, one crashed. And we went and tested that out. I think it was in about 49, I believe it was, or something like that. It was just a little while before I went to Korea, and... we were on the way to Korea, and we saw a couple out the window. So we took note of that and told the pilot and everything to find out what location we were and all
mm-hmm.
that, and
mm-hmm.
then we'd check on it later when we got back home.
Okay, Colonel, now when you and your friend went to these crash sites, were the crash sites... still open, or had they been already gone through by the government? Were most of the wreckage pieces picked up? You know how thorough they are with these things. I'm surprised you got there and there was anything there at all.
He found out before the government did, I think.
That's
my idea.
That's amazing.
But,
now, about how many were there between 1947 and 55 that you personally went and looked at?
I think they were six of them.
My goodness.
Best I can remember.
All right. Now, were in any case the craft or large pieces of the craft still on the ground, and were you able to go inside to look at the interior, or were they just, as you said, pretty much piles of scrap metal?
That's just about all every one of them I went to was that getting early.
So they hit the ground pretty hard. Did you see strange symbols? Did you see evidence of some kind of mechanical control device? Did you see very unusual construction? What did you see?
The only thing we found on most of them was the pieces of metal that was holding the cover on it. And they had strange markings on them. Like we do, we put ABC and JFK or whatever what that is on different metals that we put out for.
Right.
On there. Well, they had that on there, but we never could figure out what they were supposed to be.
They were symbols of some kind.
They were symbols of some kind. And he was really working on that when he passed on.
This is an extraordinary.
And I never did. Huh?
I say, this is an extraordinary friend of yours. This guy had some abilities that are amazing.
Yeah, he sure did. That's why I like to work with him.
I say, I'd be right with him, too. All right, now, we could spend a lot more time on that, but when we come back, I want you to start telling us your story in 1955 as an Air Force F-86 pilot, and we'll go through that as well. I am truly honored to have you on the program, sir, and to have you step forward like this. There are probably scores, if not hundreds, of aviators who have taken perhaps similar experiences with them when they leave this thing we call life and go on to the next stage. They don't share, and you've stepped up and you're sharing, and that's just a...
Well, the pilots that I flew with in different areas, they were making a career out of what they were doing, and they was asked not to say anything or discuss anything about it.
Okay, let's get right back to our special program. Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte are standing by. We're talking with Colonel Willingham about a day in 1955 that is utterly extraordinary. And the story is all the more extraordinary because he lived it. He was in the Air Force. He is telling the story now. And there are so many people in the military who know things, see things, experience things, participate in things, who take it with them. This is one of the men who did not do that, and we are eminently and eternally grateful for this information. When you click on Colonel Willingham's name at Rents.com and guests, you'll see three pictures. We hope to add several more shortly. One of them is his F-86 as he first sees the object overhead. The second is self-explanatory, and the third we will get to as well. All right, Colonel Willingham, if you would, sir, please take it from the top, 1955. What was happening on that day when this whole thing began to unroll?
All right. Sure will. We were assigned to a wingtip watch over a 47 that left up in New York, came down through Oklahoma and down through Archer County and back over and went and heading to El Paso, and we spoke to fly cover for it.
Now, when you say a 47, you're talking about a B-47?
Yes.
Okay. And why were you flying cover for a B-47?
I wasn't told why I was supposed to. I just told to it.
I'll bet you were just told to do it. Could it possibly be that that B-47 was carrying a certain something in its bomb bay?
It could have had.
Okay.
Pretty heavy one, too, I think.
Just fishing. All right.
Had big sufficient arms, you know.
I see. I got it. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So you're flying cover. You and how many fellow pilots?
Four of us.
Four of us? All right.
Four of us out of Dallas.
Were you boxing?
Fort Worth.
Out of Fort Worth. Were you boxing them in front and rear and side to side?
Yeah. Just exactly.
All right. I got the picture now. B-47, for any of you who want to know, can simply type in B-47, the numerals, in any search engine, and you'll see a picture of this this jet bomber, which was carrying, obviously, a very special cargo at that time on that day. All right, sir, go right ahead.
We flying along there, and my buddy back there said on my unicom between the aircraft, he said, "Hey, look at that big star falling there, everywhere it is over there." And I looked at it, and everybody else looked at it, and I said, it is falling, ain't it? And I said, "You sure that's a star?" I said, "It looks to me like it's something else." And it was real bright, and finally it made a 90-degree turn at 2,000 miles an hour, and I didn't figure it was.
Well, shooting stars and meteorites don't change course. Not like that.
That's right. And I asked the captain on 47 if I could trace it, see where it was going, because we didn't know what it was. And he said, "Yeah, just a minute. Let me see if we can do that." And he came back in a few minutes. He said, "Yeah, go ahead. Just you, though, not the rest of them." So I took off down there, and when I got to where it was right below Langtree, Texas, on the over on the Mexican side.
We're looking at the picture, Colonel, and the drawing, the artist's conception of that, when you first saw it looking up to your right slightly, apparently, overhead. This was prior.
Yeah.
Is this prior to the 90-degree turn that the object made?
No, it probably was part of the 90-degree. I've seen that picture you had there, but I don't think it was drawn exactly the way it was supposed to be where it made the 90-degree turn.
That thing actually just took an absolute flat-on-out 90-degree change in direction at 2,000 miles an hour, leaving a contrail of some kind behind it.
Right, right.
That must have just knocked your eyeballs.
It sure did. I was hoping to have one by the next year that I could fly myself.
Spoken like a true aviator hero. That's great. All right, so it makes a 90-degree turn. At that point, did it begin to descend below your flight altitude?
Yes, sure did. We flying along about 35,000 at that time. And I took off after it. And it hit just about the time I got about halfway there.
Okay, it dropped below you. So you went starboard or port toward it. Which direction did you descend?
I had to go, I had to go starboard there for about 5 or 8 minutes. And then I had to kind of circle around.
Mm-hmm.
And that time, the government had started sending in their troops over.
All right, so by the time you took you 5 to 8 minutes to drop down to get close to the deck to see this thing, which you could tell, I guess, from before you got there, had come in for some kind of an impact landing.
Well, I don't think it was trying to land. I think they'd already lost control of it.
I see.
Or that was my idea.
Mm-hmm. As you're coming down toward the Rio Grande River, and you're coming down, and this thing is on the ground, as you approach it, what do you see exactly?
Where it hit about 100 yards up from the water bank and kind of bounced a few times and just kept on going. I'd say it went out through there about 1,000 yards.
Did you actually see it, Colonel, hit the ground?
Well, I didn't actually see it hit the ground. I seen it when it finally got stopped. I had got that close.
I see.
That I could see it.
Uh-huh. All
but
right.
It was breaking up pretty bad there when I seen it.
Do you feel that you got there just at the time it stopped moving, or did it take you another minute to get there after it had stopped moving once it hit the ground?
Well, it was about a minute or so after that, or it could have been 30 seconds, because when you're watching something like this, the time goes by pretty fast.
Understand. All right,
yeah.
Hold on, Colonel. We have to take another little break. We'll come right back and continue your story.
Well, I'm going to go get a drink of water.
You bet. Go right ahead.
All right.
This is really amazing. For all of you who are online, do click on Colonel Robert Willingham's name. Take a look at the three pictures. And, Reuben, if you can send the other pictures along again, I've sent you an email. We'll put those up as well. These are very good artist concepts of what Colonel Willingham experienced that day, accurately marked F-86, and all the rest of it. Just an extraordinary event. Be right back with more in just a minute. Okay, and we're back with retired U.S. Air Force Reserve pilot Colonel Robert Willingham, and we're talking about an amazing event. Colonel, let me stop just for a minute and take a real quick sidetrack. When you joined the Air Force and became a pilot, an aviator, did the Air Force know of your earlier interest and apparent visits to up to 7 crashed UFO sites, or did you keep that quiet?
Oh, no, I kept it quiet.
You're sly.
I knew how the Air Force felt about it.
Uh-huh. Very good. Very smart.
They were having some hot arguments over different things that they come up with on there.
I can understand
how our Air Force and government and everything else work when it's something they don't know nothing about. They make everybody keep quiet.
Of course. Well, they're still trying to do that today.
But yeah, that's what I'm talking about, yeah.
But they do, in fact, now, as you well know, and probably for the better part of 50 years, have crash retrieval teams ready to roll out 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 a year, to pounce on these things and recover the debris, the wreckage, or the craft intact, if one happens to come down reasonably intact, and the occupants inside. They didn't back then, though.
Yeah, I went down to White Sands and looked at some of the stuff they picked up one time.
Oh, they let you look at it?
Yeah, I went down there to see what they had. It didn't look anything near like what we had. I mean, what we...
Yeah.
Picking up and looking at,
Colonel, how did they come to let you in to see this obviously highly classified, ultra-top secret wreckage? How did you get in?
Well, I do have that kind of clearance.
And you got that as a reserve pilot?
No.
All right. There's more to this story, and I'm not going to push and get in the way here of it, but...
Well, I can't talk about it anyway.
All right. Very good, sir. I understand. You've shared a tremendous amount already. Now, you're flying your F-86 down. You see the object on the ground. It had been down for no more than maybe 30 seconds by the time you flew over it, something like that?
That's right. I made one circle around it.
All right.
And looked it over, and then I headed back to my job after the B-47.
Okay.
And,
are you saying you had to try and rejoin the B-47?
Yes, sir.
All right, so you had to climb way back up to 35,000 feet or thereabouts to assume your position in that box formation of security around the B-47 bomber.
Well, the bomber had already nearly got to El Paso.
All right.
And they were going to take another team to fly a wing for it on to Arizona.
Okay, understand.
So, they called and told me, said, no, you can go on back to the base, and you want to go out there and look at that anyway. And I said, yes, I do. So I took mine and went on back, and about 5 minutes after I was there, maybe 10, the rest of them came on in. And
the other
landed.
Your other three squadron mates, okay.
Yeah. That's where we were stationed at, the Carswell Air Force Base.
All right, Carswell, yeah, all right. So you flew back to base. Now, let me ask you another question here, please. Did you, at this point in your Air Force career, have that security clearance that you mentioned, or was that to come later on?
No, I was doing a job when I got out of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
See, I didn't join the Air Force. I went to the 288th Combat Engineers, 3rd Army in Germany when I went to the service.
Was that in the war?
Yes. It
All
wasn't
right.
quite over with.
All right,
I think it was,
go ahead.
It was over with about, I think about 6 weeks later.
All right.
Because we were in April and it was the 7th of May or 9th of May is when the war was over with.
Understand. There must have been one hell of a scene, Germany just decimated like that to walk through and to be stationed at. What a scene.
Yes, it was.
Now, so after the military, the Army, then you joined the Air Force. Okay.
Well, I went to Korea as a pilot, as a radar technician.
All right.
We had, me and five guys worked on radar systems over here in Wichita Falls.
Mm-hmm.
And we come up with some ideas to make them stronger where they could reach further and everything. And me and my buddy, the general, said, you get your stuff ready and we'll ship you to Korea. And they said, all right, and said, we'll have you the 636 radar squadron there
mm-hmm.
for you to work on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, that's the type of radar systems we had that working on.
All right, that's obviously very highly classified work at that point in time. I understand.
Yes, it was.
All right.
You couldn't talk about what you'd done or what you were going to do or what was happening, you know.
I understand.
But anyway, we went ahead and got that there, and we got all set up and waited 2 weeks, and they didn't show up. And I said, you're a P-51 pilot, aren't you? And he said, yeah. I said, hey, there's two old P-51s out there. Let's go get them and get the mechanics out here and get them all together and fly them. What do you say? Yeah, that'd be a good idea.
Wait a minute. Well, where were you when you decided to take these P-51s?
That was on that island off in the mainland of Korea.
Okay. Honshu or something? I can't remember the name of it. One of them.
I can't either.
All right.
I've had...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You see, I've had what?
I've had two bad strokes and five little strokes. I can't think too fast or too far either.
Well, you're putting a lot of me to shame right now with the way you're remembering this and bringing it out, so don't even talk there. That's amazing what you remember. You're doing wonderfully. So you got in these two P-51s. What was the idea? You were going to fly them where?
We were going to strafe for the 2nd Marine Division that was over in the mainland.
When did you learn to fly, Robert? I don't understand. You were an Army, you were in the Engineers in the end of World War II. When did you get your flight training and certification?
47. I got my field commission. And they asked me what I was would I like to go to school to do something. And I said, yeah, I want to be a pilot. And the minute I got to the States, they called me about 4 months later and told me my appointment had come through. So I went to training in them.
Very good. All right. So you popped in the 51s and took off and did your job helping the Marines. And then after the Korean War, you came back and got checked out on 86s, or was that during the Korean War?
Well, I got checked out while the Korean. See, I went to Korea in 50.
Ah, early.
And it wasn't over until 53, I think it was, or 54, somewhere along in there. But they blowed me out of a hole. I like to lost both legs then.
You got shot down?
Yeah.
You were shot down?
Yeah.
On a
like 50... lost both kneecaps. They shipped me to Tokyo Hospital. And, boy, I tell you, those Japanese operators were pretty good, I'll tell you, because they lasted nearly 12 years. After they operated on them, before I started having any more trouble.
Oh, that's nice. So you're able to get your 86 training and fly that and actually experience what you're talking about tonight. Were you shot down in a P-51?
No.
Well,
we were going to go to Korea to Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And have a weekend off.
Right.
And we got airborne and was out about 5 minutes and we shot us down.
Who shot you down?
The Koreans did.
North Koreans did. But what were you flying in?
We were in a C-47.
Ah, I thought it was a bigger aircraft. Okay.
Yeah. And there's about 10 of us on there.
Pilot was able to make a crash landing?
Yeah. We crashed right down the shoreline of the a little island out there.
Amazing.
Called Kiwi.
Amazing. Amazing story. All right. We're coming up on another short break here. I want you to go get another drink of water. And when we come back, we're going to pick up the story. When you flew back to Carswell, checked your F-86 in, and then went back to the crash location of this disc you had seen come down to Earth and hit the deck about 100 yards from the Rio Grande River. We'll do that.
Well, I sure like to get in trouble at the time, too.
Yeah, all right. You hang on. This is a great story.
I'll tell you about that in a minute.
All right. Stand by. Go get a drink of water. We'll be gone for about 4 minutes, and then we'll talk to you again. All right. Colonel Robert B. Willingham, U.S. Air Force Reserve, retired war hero, World War II, Korean War service veteran. This is an amazing American, and he is telling a story that I think we could all spend hours talking to him about. There just aren't folks like that around very often anymore. Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte are with us as well, listening in. They've written a book about this. You can find it at RoswellBooks.com, and we'll be right back.
He's lost. heart disease.
Glad you're along with us tonight. A very special program this evening. Ruben Uriarte and Noe Torres making it possible. Those gentlemen are standing by listening in. Our very special guest tonight is Colonel Robert Willingham, U.S. Air Force Reserve, retired, World War II, Korean War veteran, a true hero of this nation and of our country's history. He is telling us the story of 1955. We're jumping around a bit because his life is so extraordinary, of the day he saw a disc, a UFO, from above, when he was at 35,000 feet, come down, make a right-angle turn, and come all the way down and land near the Texas-Mexico border, about 100 yards from the Rio Grande River. Colonel, you wanted to tell us one thing right before we went to the break. Do you remember what that was?
Now, what was I talking about?
I can't remember, but you said, I'll tell you about that a little later.
Okay.
Only you know, well, sir.
Well, I'm going to go back where we went and took the jet back.
Yeah, you went back and parked at Carswell. Okay.
Yeah, I parked the car and got in the car and went down to Corsicana, where I used to fly out of that base down there.
All right.
And picked up a light aircraft and flew down to where the crash was.
When you say you picked up a light aircraft, what did you do, rent some little single-engine craft?
No, a good friend of mine down there had four of them, and he used them for people that wanted to keep their flying time up. And, in fact, he even taught my wife how to fly.
Nice.
I picked up a light aircraft. It was an L-16.
All right.
And didn't have no batteries, didn't have no generator or anything like that, no clearance lights, nothing on it.
But it had a hell of a powerful rubber band, right?
That's right.
All right.
That's about all it had. So I went on down there and found a place that was clean enough I could sit down.
Uh-huh.
And I sat down, and
did you have any trouble finding the location of the crash from the air? You remembered it pretty clearly, I guess.
Yes, I did. I still got it right in my mind right now.
All right.
You just go from Langtree, Texas.
Okay.
Right straight to the river, and just on the other side of it was where it hit.
All right. You landed how close to the crash itself?
I'd say I was about 150, 200 yards.
That's damn close. Okay, when you got there, what did you see?
Well, I started up there, and here come all these Spanish soldiers come running over, and they was all armed. And I put up my hands like I was being arrested, you know, or something.
Really? Were you still in uniform?
Yeah, I was still in my flight suit. But anyway, they come on up there, and I told them, I said, I just come down to see what crashed here. I was here a while ago in that F-84. And he said, you were? And I said, yeah. I spoke a little Spanish, but they were the lieutenant there. He spoke good English, so I talked to him most of the time.
And they remembered your F-86 overflying the location where they couldn't have been there already, or were they there that quickly?
Well, they only had about 4 miles to drive.
I see. So they had a base nearby, and they just saw this thing come down, and they zipped on over there.
That's right. They just zipped right on over there.
All right. So you're standing there with your arms up in your flight suit next to this little private plane, and you're 150 yards away from this crash disk. How many soldiers were there approximately there, and were they deployed in a circle around it or what?
No, it was about, I'd say 150 there when I got there.
All right, so quite a number.
Already.
Right? Mm-hmm.
And about 35 vehicles.
Wow, all right. Could you see
vehicles on both sides.
All right, could you see the craft itself?
Yeah, I went in there and I was talking to this Spanish lieutenant. I used to remember his name, but I can't even think of it now. I talked to him, and we walked down through there, and he said, I never seen anything like it before. And I said, no, I either. But I said, this site's a little different than some I've looked at. Mostly it was all pieces of covering and stuff. It was all scattered everywhere. This one here had some solid pieces still scattered down through there.
All right, so some of it was intact. Did it have any markings or anything on the exterior, or was it just the skin of it?
Well, no, I picked up a little piece of it on the way out of there.
Well, I know. I want to get there in just a minute. Hold on with that, please. You walk up to this thing. Well, did the Mexicans let you get close to it, or did they hold you off a little bit?
No, they helped me off till the lieutenant got up there.
All right, and when he got there...
I don't think they spoke very good English, the rest of them did.
All right. I hope they weren't putting their guns on you all this time.
Well, they had them pointed that direction.
I get it. I get the picture. All right, so the lieutenant gets there. You walk up to the craft itself. How close did you get to it, Colonel?
I walked right up and kicked a piece of it.
Wow. All right. How big was it in diameter, about?
Well, where it hit, it was a lot of small pieces, like 2 foot by 8 inches. Maybe 2 foot by 28 inches. Just different pieces off of it, you know.
Okay.
Then it got on up to where it stopped. It looked to me like that it was a piece of 10-inch pipe that was real shiny. And I don't know if that was part of the fuel consumption part of it or what it was. But he didn't know either. The Mexican didn't.
Could you see inside what was left of the intact craft?
No. Wasn't nothing like that in there.
Was there any evidence of any life, dead or alive, around that object?
They were on up front, according to them. They said, don't look like people, but said, we can't let you go up there. The generals already said, no, nobody look at that.
So
they didn't even let the boys that was guarding it look at it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so the front of the craft that impacted the ground ripped a hole open inside, and apparently people could see in there, and there were dead ETs, or they weren't humans. There were dead bodies in there of some kind.
Right, right.
And you couldn't get around there to see in there either.
Well, I kind of snuck around a little bit.
You're a sneaky fella, aren't you? All right, now tell you snuck around there a little bit, Colonel. What did you see?
Well, it didn't look like human beings to me.
How many of them were there?
I believe there were 3, and the lieutenant said there were 4.
All right.
And I never did see the other one.
Were the bodies mangled, or were they relatively intact, and what were they dressed in?
Well, they weren't dressed at all.
Okay.
And they were in a lot of different pieces. I didn't see but one that had a complete top. But I wouldn't swear what he was eating.
All right. What did the head look like? Anything like we've seen in the common research literature, the big eyes, the smooth skin, or the little mouth? Did you see anything?
Yeah, at least some of them that looked like that. They just, I don't know how you'd explain it, but they just, their heads and arms and stuff, their arms are a little bitty. They look like broomsticks.
Wow, okay. But
that's
they had...
How big...
Uh-huh, broomsticks.
Go ahead.
All right, no, I got you. They had no uniform on. They were just basically skin, if that's what their outer covering is.
Yeah.
No, any evidence of blood?
I didn't see any.
Okay, but they were...
Man,
they were all...
I just got the glance in there, because he wouldn't let me go look in it. I just happened to be walking by it and looking in there, you know, and he said,
yeah.
No, you can't do that. You got to come over here.
You're a smart man. I'm glad you did. The colonel actually got a look, listeners, I'm sure you're right on this, of the occupants of that craft, all dead on impact, apparently. And we'll come right back. Colonel, stand by, if you would, please. Get yourself a drink of water. You're doing wonderfully here, describing an extraordinary event. We'll come right back with Colonel Robert Willingham in just a couple of minutes. Fascinating conversation with Colonel Robert Willingham, U.S. Air Force Reserve, retired American war hero, World War II, Korea War, and then some. And we've uploaded three more pictures. If you'll click on the colonel's name at Rents.com, you'll see him in his uniform. You'll see him in a couple other pictures as well, so enjoy those. And then the three images of the jet when he first saw the object. The second image showing the F-86 coming down and circling over the crashed disc. And the third we're going to get to in just a minute. Okay, you're a sly one. You got around, you got a look in there, you got a look at these guys. Did you see anything on the inside, Colonel, that looked like controls or creature comforts, chairs, consoles, anything at all that you can remember?
Well, it's a little something else. You kept saying a disc-like. It wasn't a disc-like. It was, I'd say it was about the size, about 4 foot in the front.
Right.
And then it came back, being 4 feet, and then it squeezed down to about 2 feet. And then it came on down till it was about 2 feet on the back. But it didn't have any ailerons or anything like ours do, you know.
All right. It sounds like you're describing kind of a tadpole shape or something, bigger in the front and more narrow in the back, like a teardrop.
Right.
But the image on our website shows a disc shape, so I'm glad you clarified that for us. Thank you. This was not a huge piece of machinery, and yet it's up there at above 35,000 feet, doing 2,000 miles an hour, making aerodynamically absolutely fantastic movements, and then crashing.
Yes, and that's what when I got down there where I could see what I was looking at, you know. Yeah, I was thinking, now that's not even aerodynamics pattern.
Right.
But it's something different. Because the other crashes I looked at were round disc, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were like a big tank, I guess you'd say.
Okay.
It was about 12, 14 foot wide, or diameter sparks, you know.
Yeah.
And they was just all different kinds of them. I don't believe I've seen but two that was just alike.
How interesting. So of the seven or so you saw from 1947 to 1955, only two of them were what you would call possibly identical. The other five were all different.
That's right, yeah.
What brought Colonel, what brought those craft down in your estimation? Were they shot down? Did they just mechanically screw up? Did our radar interfere with some of them?
I figure that probably the radar worked on their control of the engine that was driving it.
Uh-huh. That's been suggested before, and I just wanted to ask you if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, me and my buddy that we worked on with before, that's what we're trying to find out what made it go.
Yeah, I'd like to know that, too.
Yeah. I may need a lot of people like to know.
Yeah. Wow.
But I had them strokes, and I had to quit working on them. That's all it was to it.
All right. So you walked around the front. You did see at least three, maybe four bodies in various pieces. One of them was half together from the waist up or thereabout. They had broom handle thickness arms. Their heads and legs. Can you describe the face at all? Just a little thin mouth. Did you see eyes?
The top of their head was big.
All right.
Like from their eyes up. Now, I have never, these they draw on their great big eyes.
Yep.
I never seen any of them.
All right. The eyes look kind of normal size?
Yeah, well, they were a lot smaller, but they were shaped different. Looked like the eyeball itself was sticking out past the eyelids on there.
No hair at all?
No hair. Might have been a little on the back of some of them.
Okay.
Because there was something back there, but it didn't look like hair. It looked like something else. It might have been some heat resistant stuff. I don't know.
All right. Last question about that. Were there any chairs or instrumentation that you could see in your quick glance inside there?
I noticed in there that they were, looked like, seismograph machines in there, and a lot of writing on ever what was under it.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Very interesting. Was the interior of the craft still lit up in any way, or did it have colors you could see in there of any kind?
No, didn't see a thing like that.
All right.
I didn't even see a dome light.
Well, how interesting, not even a dome light. But you looked at four dead fellow aviators in a way. Have you ever thought about that over the years?
More than once. What would I have done if I was in that same condition?
How interesting.
That's what I was trying to figure out.
Yeah. All right. We got another major thing coming up with the Colonel in just a couple of minutes. Stand by, and we will continue with this remarkable story I heard first on radio here. Thanks to Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte, and of course, Colonel Willingham. Okay, we're back with our very special guest, Colonel Robert B. Willingham, U.S. Air Force Reserve, retired. All right, Colonel, what happened after you walked around the craft and got your peak, invaluable peak inside? The lieutenant walked you away. Did he escort you away? Did he say you better walk away now? What did he do?
Yeah, he said, let's turn around and go back. I got to get you out of here because the general's here.
All right. Well, he did. He,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. He did you a favor, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah, I told him, I said, well, let's walk over and introduce me to him. He said, no. We're going to get you out of here, so you get your airplane and get out of here. And I went back and got in there. I went back home, and it liked to got dark on me. I didn't have no clearance lights or nothing on that aircraft.
All right. Now, but before, Colonel, you got into your rubber band-powered airplane with no clearance lights and all the rest of it, you saw something on the ground.
Yeah, I picked up a little piece of metal.
Was there a lot of it scattered all over the place?
Yeah, it was scattered everywhere. And it was about, I think, 6-8 inches wide. I measured it then, but I done forgot what it was.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, one side of it had the notches on it, like it was going to be in some kind of driver or something, you know.
Colonel, excuse me, I'm sorry. It had notches in it?
Yeah, on one side.
All right. Now, there's an artist drawing of this, folks. You click on Colonel Willingham's name, and you'll see it. It's got notches on one side and little holes on the other side of it.
Right, yeah. Yeah. You
okay.
Got that on...
Yeah, it's on
the TV, huh?
We got it on the internet, on the TV screen, and people can see it. That's correct.
Good. Then they know what I'm talking about.
That's right. They got an idea. It's slightly curved, and you picked it up. And did you pretend to reach down to tie your shoelace when you grabbed this thing, or what?
I sure did.
You did?
I sure did.
Oh, you're amazing. All right, how did I know that? I'd have just probably done the same darn thing. Well, good for you.
Anyway, I sent that to Ohio.
Good military man that you are, you sent it to Wright-Patterson, right?
Right. And it disappeared in 3 days.
Doggonest thing. Now, if you had it to do over again, what would you have done?
I'd have took it myself and I'd have stayed with it.
Yeah, well...
The major that I gave that to, he was a Marine.
Mm-hmm.
And I could never find him again. I went to Washington even trying to find him through their papers, you know.
Yeah, I understand.
Ticker tape, you know, and stuff.
Okay.
Back then.
Yeah, so you felt that was your piece and you wanted it back.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Well, I agree with you.
I'd have found out what it was, too.
Yeah, I believe it. Did you do anything with it? Did you do anything with it by way of testing it before you gave it to this major?
Yeah, I tried to even grind it. You couldn't grind it even. It was so hard.
Was it heavy?
I tried a file on it, and it cut the edges off my file.
Wow. Was it light or heavy?
Well, if that had been a piece of regular iron, it would have weighed probably 6 or 8 pounds.
Okay.
That, I don't think, weighed over about 3, maybe 4 pounds.
All right.
But I couldn't figure out how they could have got metal that hard and still be that light.
Yes, I understand. That's probably a question that the military may know the answer to by now, given all the crashes that they've retrieved and all the rest of the pieces of hardware they've analyzed. But back then,
right, in the 50s,
so it took the edge off your metal file. Your grinder was useless on it. Wouldn't even scuff it up at all, huh?
Not a bit.
Were you married at the time?
Yes.
Did you show the missus?
No.
All right. I understand.
I sure did.
I understand. Did anybody... All right, so you gave it to the major. It vanished. What contact did you have afterward from the military regarding... they knew you were there. They knew you picked up a piece and all that. So what happened after that?
They sent four guys down. I was living in Corsicana then, I think.
Okay.
Well, somewhere down there anyway.
All right.
Sent four guys down there and told me they wanted it. Told me not to tell anybody about it or anything.
How did they tell you? Did they make it real clear that something nasty might happen to you if you did, or did they just appeal to your service allegiance to the country?
Well, I think the first batch did just ask me not to say anything about it.
All right.
And that's the last. So then I come down here, and they've been talking to my mother.
Oh.
And my mother said, well, I know nothing about it. And if you want to talk to him, you'll have to talk to him about it, because he's pretty secretive anyway. And I said, oh, don't tell him that. But anyway, they come down. I see, I was at home, come home just about the time they left. And I didn't get to see them myself. But then I was at... Pittsburgh, checking one out, and they'd one crashed north of Pittsburgh there, about 17 miles, I think it was.
Was this later on?
Yeah, this was before the first one.
Okay, so this is before 1955.
Yeah, this was in about 51, I believe.
Okay.
It's
all right.
I was on a crutch. I was walking around on crutches.
Because your knees in the Korean War shoot down.
Yeah.
I got it.
And,
well, this, Colonel, this friend of yours had some kind of an ability to figure out where these things were coming down, or he watched the newspapers or something, and you and he went around to all these crash sites. That's just amazing.
Well, we tried to anyway.
That's remarkable. All right.
And he paid all the expenses.
Was this guy, this friend of yours, in the government service at all at this time, did you feel?
He was working in the Pentagon.
And he decided to take you with him.
Well, I ran across him on one of these sites over in the edge of New York.
I
and
see.
His job was to go and find out all he can and then come back and tell him.
Okay. Stand by, Colonel. We'll take a break. Come right back again in about 2 minutes, please. Be right back. Okay, and we are back, and very honored to have been hearing an incredible story from an American hero, Colonel Robert B. Willingham, U.S. Air Force Reserve, retired. They don't make him like Colonel Willingham anymore. Sir, if you would go ahead and tell me a little bit more about the military's efforts to keep you quiet. Now, what the interesting thing is to me is that this gentleman you talked about, who you went to so many crashes with over the years, obviously was told it was okay to take you along. They had that much respect for you, and you had been doing this since 1947, and you ran into him at the site of one of these crashes. When you ran into him for the first time, was it very early on like in 1947, 48, or was it later on?
Well, we didn't get together after that first meeting till about, I think, must have been about close to 50.
All right.
And I was getting ready to go to Korea, and I didn't have very much time to work with him.
Understand. But when you came back on crutches, he got in contact with you again, did he?
Yes. He got, well, my mother said he called every month to see where I was at and what I was doing.
Well, you guys got along real well, and he obviously had a great deal of respect for you in addition to that. So you and he were kind of the Pentagon team for investigating early UFO crashes.
Well, could have been, but I didn't like the people they had ahead of that.
Mm.
It was in that time.
But you liked him fine.
I liked him fine. He was a fine man.
Well, I hear that in your voice.
Sure did hate to bring to leave us like he did.
How did he leave us?
He just had a heart attack and died.
I see. Okay. Now, that happens. But look at all the wonderful years you had with him. That's to be blessed. And
yeah, I sure did. I enjoyed him very much.
All right.
And every time I had a little time off, I'd go see him.
That's a real friend. A real nice man.
Yeah, he was real jam-up good feller.
Glad to hear it. They don't make people like that very often anymore, except in your case, Colonel, and you're another good one.
Well,
take my word for it.
Some of them around here don't seem to think so.
Well, I sure do, and you made a lot of friends tonight. Now, did the military ever come up to you? Now, you keep in mind, folks, that Colonel Willingham is working, obviously, with someone out of the Pentagon, exploring and investigating and researching these crashes. But did they come up to you regarding that piece of metal or anything else and say, look, keep your mouth shut or else? Did they ever get that ugly with you?
They was six of them come to a place where I was at, and it was in an air base, and they just walked in there, and they wanted to know where H. Willingham was. And they come over there, and one of them started chewing me out, and another one started bellowing, too. And I picked up a ball-peen hammer and told him, I said, we don't use that kind of language around here, and if you want to talk to me, lower your voice.
Wow, good.
And I said, I think it'd be the best if you just got up and went back home.
And did they take the hint?
Yeah, after about 5 minutes, a couple of my buddies come over. One of them was 6'4" and weighed about 240. And he said, when he says something, you do it. And they got up and left.
That's a very, very interesting little vignette. And that was pretty much the end of their hassling you?
Yeah, most of the guys that they sent out to talk to me about them things were real nice people.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, two of them I'd served with one time.
I see.
And, just good people.
Right.
And I didn't mind telling them about them because I thought the government should know everything they could find out about them.
Right.
And that's why I worked on it so hard, so long.
Understand.
Was I trying to help the government as much as I was finding out about them. And seeing these little people and everything running around, I never got to do that.
Did you ever have any of your own UFO sightings apart from the time you were in your F-86? Did you, just as a citizen, private citizen, as a youngster, a young boy, did you have any events or experiences that were unusual back then?
When I was about 16 years old, they had a sighting over a little town south west of me here. And I think I seen that. Me and a friend of mine, we were talking about it, and we went told my mother about it, and she told Daddy about it, and Daddy told the sheriff about it, and they all come out.
I see.
That's the way you do in a little town way off from everywhere else, you know.
I see. I do. I understand. All right. Now, as far as the story itself goes, you've done a marvelous job of recounting something that was obviously real and obviously from somewhere else. How do you view this now at this stage in your life? Do you think that this knowledge of this planet being visited by other beings, other intelligent life forms, should be the province and kept secret by the government, or do you think all people have a birthright to know this? What are your views?
Well, I'll put it this way. I've seen a lot of things that didn't look right as far as flying. But I do know, and I even went to Virginia and looked at them, and I was nearly going to try to get checked out, one of them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they had made two down in Virginia, just like round, you know, like what everybody draws when mm-hmm. they say unidentified flying objects, you know.
Right, right.
But
now you say, sir, that these were recreated by us to copy what crashed?
Yes.
I see. And this
the round ones.
This would have been in the 50s?
No, that was about 60, I'd say.
All right, so we were in the business of trying to duplicate or replicate some of these crashed objects back in the late, certainly the late 50s or very early 60s, or before then. Was the effort to replicate these, as far as you could tell, a very serious one to try to get something that would fly, or just to try and see if we could even duplicate the basic shape of the things?
Oh, they flew them. They'd get off about 18 feet off the ground and things with it. But they didn't have the right kind of the power to go in that the regular saucers had in them.
Colonel, are you saying you witnessed a duplicated, crashed UFO, ET flown, that we made, that we actually were able to get up off the ground?
Oh, yes. Yes. They film on it. In fact, I think I got one.
You
I'll
think you have
a... If I have, I'll let you have it.
You have a film of one? Well, they'll be knocking
yeah,
on your. They'll be. I'll tell you right now. If you got it, you better have that 6'4" friend of yours hanging around because they'll be over knocking on your door tomorrow morning asking for it. I wouldn't give it to them. But this is. Oh, you check. If you get that film, make sure that Reuben and Noe get it, and it's copied.
Well, I just found it. It's been hit for about 8 years.
All right. Well, Reuben and Noe, you know how important this is, so I'm sure they'll be on this. I am.
Yeah,
this is
I'll
very
look
important.
It up and I'll make
right.
sure Reuben gets it.
All right, and I'd be very honored to see it at some point.
We have
to take a break. Can you hang on for a little bit longer, another 10 minutes or so?
Well, I'm not just going to hang on. I'm going to go get a drink of water, as you say.
You do that.
And
you do whatever else
okay.
you need to do. And then you come back. I want to talk to you a little bit more. All right. Go get
All
your
right.
drink of water, sir.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Bye-bye.
Bring Reuben and Noe back up real quick, if you can, studio. You there, Reuben?
Yes.
Noe?
Yes, I'm right here.
All right, you guys, that's absolutely an astonishing interview, and we'll ask our third-hour guest just to stand by a little longer. I want to say proper good night and thanks to Robert. Have we missed anything that you need to have included in here to make this a total presentation that you'd like to have?
I think most of the major topics have been covered. Reuben and I have just been sitting here stunned all over again listening to this amazing story.
Well, me too. I mean, we just heard him say that we replicated these things, and he saw them flying, albeit low to the ground, with not the same propulsion, in around 1960.
Well, I think he was referring, Jeff, to, he told us he flew the Avro car. Do you remember?
Yeah, sure.
He actually had a chance to test.
Yeah, I understand. But that's what he was saying was that we had duplicated this basic shape, and we were able to get them up off the ground. Mm-hmm. I didn't know the Avro went back to the 1960, though. I thought it was later than that, but okay. Fascinating. We'll come back. Gentlemen, thank you. I'm going to say a proper good night to him, and then we'll bring you back on, and we'll kind of do a little review and then say good night to you. So thank you. Stand by. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a few more minutes. Okay, welcome back. I'm almost without words. This has been an extraordinary conversation. Colonel, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, sir, I want to thank you, but before I say goodnight, I want to ask you if there's anything you'd like to add to this story, and you've done just a fantastic job of explaining it.
Well, I'm thinking right now about getting me a stenographer and writing down everything from 1940 till now.
1940?
Yeah.
That goes back to the Missouri crash, if I'm not mistaken, or somewhere around.
Right.
You were in, did you go see that one, too?
I went by there when they set it up in the, more or less, a place to where you go look at that stuff, in an old hangar.
They had
the name of that town.
Cape Girardeau.
Well, that sounds pretty close.
Was there some wreckage there that they had on display?
Yes. They claim it was a flying saucer, and I went in there and looked at it, and I didn't believe it. Because they didn't have wheels like that on the flying saucers and things like that. I thought it was somebody that had made one and was flying it.
I see. Well, that's certainly within their realm of possibility. I think your idea is very good. I think Noe and Ruben might want to help you with that. Just get your... all of your experiences put down on a recording device, and then someone could type them up. This is part of our heritage on the planet as a species, to know these things. Our government, of course, as you well know, does not think we are deserving of knowing that we are being visited by intelligent life forms continually. Probably have been here maybe long before we have.
Well, yes. I figured they were here before we even got here the first time.
I wouldn't be surprised if
that's
we
were... That's the way I looked at it.
We might even be something they created long ago. Who knows? Or meddled with
that's
somehow.
Right. That's right.
I hope you do put your
I
memories down.
I always have an open eye when it comes to these.
Yes.
Or try to.
You have one of the great... Sir, you have one of the great stories that I have ever heard in my life. One of the most important stories, and I do encourage you to Even if you just take it one event at a time and sit down and just speak into a recording device as much as you can remember, I'm sure that Ruben and Noe will help you and make sure you get the proper support to do this. This is one of the most important breakthroughs in UFO research that I have ever been privileged to be a tiny part of and just to listen in. You are bringing to the table the truth that many of us know and have heard fragments of, but for some reason, sir, you have been involved in the primary thread of this whole phenomenon, which is the investigation of actual crashed hardware and dead occupants, and some occupants that obviously weren't dead. What do you know about the Roswell crash you can tell us?
Well, I was stationed down at White Sands when it happened.
Well, I'm not surprised. And?
There was a lot of stuff went on down there I really didn't approve of, and I kind of got up and got asked him if I could go somewhere else.
Really? If you can just briefly tell me, what was it about what was going on down there that didn't sit right with you, just in general terms? What was it? The attitude of the people?
Well, the people down there, the way they were, we'd say, one guy said, well, I seen these two people laying out here, and they'd all jump up and say, no, you didn't see no people laying out there. It wasn't nothing like that, you know, and things like that. And they'd say, oh, you were seeing things, or you were probably drunk that night. And I said, now, don't say he was drunk, because I can't even get him to smell of the bottle.
Yeah, I don't like it either. I understand what you're saying. Did you go to the Roswell site at all?
No, I
okay.
didn't.
Can you?
I was busy as a cat on a hot tin roof, and they were making stuff down there that I had to have, and I had to stay there and make sure they got stayed at.
You were in charge. Can you tell our listeners, and you're speaking to a lot of very wise people here, unequivocally, without question, that the Roswell crash or crashes did happen?
Yes, it did. It did happen, and it was very poorly taken care of.
You got to have a lot of sympathy for Jesse Marcel having to sit there with that phony weather balloon crap in those pictures. You can see on his face how unhappy he was.
Well, I know what he was going through.
Yeah.
I one time went by there in a Jeep, and I stopped and I said, we brought you a six-pack. I thought maybe it'd help what was going on here. He just died laughing.
You did that to Jesse?
Yeah.
Well, what an amazing little sidelight. Just amazing. Good for you.
We had to do something or we'd have lost our minds.
Yeah, I hear you.
To keep something going on.
Yeah. That's an amazing little story. I'm going to let you get some rest, and I want to also tell you that if you would like to come back on the program at your convenience in a week or two or whenever you'd like to, as long as the goons from the government don't come down and threaten you, and I have a hunch it doesn't matter if they did, you'd still do what you're exactly going to do anyhow. That's the kind of man you are. But you're welcome to come back on this program and talk to me and our listeners about what you've been through and share as much of this as you'd like.
Well, I don't think the government's going to bother me very much. Lost my legs and I've lost my back and my mind's going and things like that, and I don't think they'll bother me.
Colonel, your mind is working better than 90% of what they call Americans now walking around out there. So,
thank you very much.
Don't you go there.
I think I was losing it.
No, sir. So please consider this an invitation and just let Ruben or Noe know that you'd like to come back on and spend a little time talking with us about whatever you'd like, and I'll be honored to do that.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate you letting me do it.
Honest, my pleasure, sir. Take good care, and I do hope to talk to you again, and thank you.
All right, thank you, and tell the two boys there you got, I said, go home, go to bed.
All right, they will, I will. Good night, sir.
Yeah, okay,
bye-bye. Good night. Are the two boys there?
I'm right here, Jeff. Amazing.
I can't even begin to extend my thanks to both of you for making this possible. And he wants to tell it all, and I know you'll be on it.
Yeah, he's a great, very, like you said, a great hero.
Truly.
Jeff, I wanted to point out that he really brought forward a lot more details tonight.
Did he? It was really amazing.
There was a lot of information that has come back into his mind in the 2 years since our book was published.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the information he shared tonight is was just, it really floored us. He has been thinking about this a lot since he helped us, since we got the book together with his help.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he filled in a lot more detail, for example, what he saw in the crashed craft that really has never been heard or seen anywhere before until tonight. So Reuben and I would like to thank you for kind of getting the colonel out of his shell and having him come forward and give a lot more vivid information than even we had on hand 2 years ago when we did the book.
Wow. Well, he's a remarkable man, and I just couldn't have enjoyed speaking to anyone any more than and talking to that fine American hero. You heard his mind was coming alive. You heard it. It's just right there.
That's correct.
Just like it was yesterday with him. All right, gentlemen, we're about out of time this go-round, but please, in a week or two, if he'd like to come back, talk to him. We'll set it up just to have him list some other things he'd like to discuss, and we'll do it anytime you'd like.
Great, Jeff. There's more chapters due to his life.
I'm sure. Noe, thank you, my friend. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Our pleasure. Reuben, take good care. Talk soon.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Good night.
Good night.
All right. Wow. We're going to pause, and we will be back. Okay, welcome back, and we want to thank Jay Widener for standing by for a few extra minutes tonight so we could wrap that up. Jay, are you there?
I am. Quite amazing.
Quite amazing.
Yes.
I'll tell you, I was hanging on his every word. That man's mind is as sharp as it probably ever was. He let go of some things that you could tell he'd been sitting on for a long, long time.
Definitely. It's very interesting because at that time period, you know, it was before the National Security Agency and everything started bottling everything up, and there was this small window after World War II till about 58 or so.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, boy, we just haven't really been able to get much information at all.
No, well, as you well know, and many of you listening know, the 1950s were really pretty much the age of the UFO sighting here. I mean, we have George Van Tassel on the whole contactee thing, but above that, newspapers back then were not owned by four or five corporations in a huge conglomerate. They were owned by thousands of different entities, companies, enterprises, individuals, and they reported these things. They were all over the newspapers, front page stories with pictures, eyewitness accounts. It was big news. And then the lid came down. Boom. And then the newspaper consolidation, the whole media consolidation trend came along, and that was the end of it.
Well, maybe it even wasn't a trend. Maybe it was all part of this national security apparatus.
Could they, easily be.
Yeah,
when you've got unlimited money, Jay, as you know, for black ops, why wouldn't a black op be to buy up control of the media? Why not?
Well, and then the question is, why did all this happen in, 1947, 1948, which is exactly when the CIA was created, the United Nations,
right.
The NSA, all these things are created right at the same time. And it wasn't, the historians argue that it was a result of World War II, but, that begs the question, why'd you wait so long, Why wasn't it all ready and up at 45, 46? If you were worried about the Soviet Union and all that, and I'm sure they were worried about the Soviet Union, but
right.
There's more to this, and what it is it goes back, thousands of years in Earth's history of contact and this presence, and they do not want us to know about it. They just do not.
Because it will open the door to the big picture, and they don't want us to have a clue about that. Just a couple more words about Colonel Willingham. This man, for some reason, is, to the best of my ability to analyze this, the highest level insider ever to go public with this level of disclosure.
Yep.
He was involved with the Pentagon investigation of these crashes for many years with someone he held in extremely high personal regard. This is as insider as we're going to get, as much of an insider as we're going to get coming forward with. I could not believe what I was hearing, and everything had the 100% ring of absolute truth. This man knows exactly what he's talking about. And has a hell of a lot more that he hadn't even touched.
Yeah, I think got to get him back, because we got to get this stuff down before it's too late. And you're right. There's a certain way of listening to people, and when you can hear their thought processes through the words, and when they're telling the truth, they're searching for the right, correct answer.
Right.
And you could tell that was going on with him. He was not making this up. There's just no way. So.
But going back to, think about it, though, 1940, 41,
yeah.
Cape Girardeau, Missouri,
yeah.
The first major UFO crash, and he said that one had wheels, at least what they were showing people back then. I suspect there was a crash, the debris was collected and taken away, and some carny types put together something, and they were trying to make a buck. That's what I heard.
Yeah, that could be. But the one that Zamora saw in New Mexico, that in the middle of the highway, that had wheels.
1957, was it?
Early on, there,
yeah.
We don't know what.
Yeah.
At that point, there was a mixture of the military trying to back engineer and the real stuff.
Right.
And what he saw was the real stuff.
He did.
Yeah, not the back engineered stuff, which was really quite crappy if you look at
well,
it
nowadays. Well, when he said that they had things in around 1960 that were shaped like them, could fly, could only go about 18 feet up. That was amazing to me because it confirmed what we thought, and certainly the Avro car and the other things that were in that time disc-shaped were indicative of a back engineering effort. That was a lot, that part of it was public, and we could get a glimpse at it. The Avro car, for those of you who are sharp and remember, kind of just vanished all of a sudden, and it was getting too close to what they were doing.
That's right.
They didn't want that around.
Thompson Brown, he was getting too close.
That's right. That's
as
right.
As soon as you get too close, then you disappear, or your work disappears, and you get sucked up into the grand maw of this of this secret. It's an incredible secret that they'll do anything to put us, keep us in complete ignorance of.
That man's mind was, I have never in 17 years this June, never heard anyone more fascinating, more truthful, and I don't know how old he is now, probably in his 80s.
I was about to say, he has to be.
But he's right there.
Oh, yeah.
110%.
His mind is sharp. There was no doubt about it.
Yep, yep. Talking with Jay Widener. Jay is on with us once a month, and we urge you to visit his website. We'll be back to talk to Jay about how far back this whole phenomenon goes, and it goes all the way back, and obviously even before then. And it's not just one civilization, one form of advanced intelligent being or species. There are lots and lots of them out there. This whole idea that anybody could for a moment buy that we're the only game in the universe is hardly worth commenting on. It's so asinine. All right, back in just a minute.
Known worldwide as the most...
Okay, and we're back talking with our friend and colleague of many, many years, Jay Widener, whose website and whose work, by the way, regarding Stanley Kubrick, the moon, the staged moon landings that Kubrick was involved with, and so many other things are just fascinatingly timeless reading. Go to Jay's website. Just click on his name and go there. All right, my friend, let's take it from the long-haul perspective.
You know, if you read the Vedic texts and the Mahabharata, which are probably the oldest texts passed down from oral tradition.
How many years old?
Well, oral tradition, you know, it was recorded within the last 2,000 years, but the oral tradition for sure goes back at least 6,000, if not 10, 12,000.
Mm-hmm.
The Indians say 10, 12,000 or hundreds of thousands of years, but you know, modern historians don't accept that, so the best they'll give it is a 5,000-year-long oral tradition that was written down a couple thousand years ago.
Well, 10 to 12,000 years would take it into the last great cataclysm, whatever that was or wasn't.
Right, and in fact, the Aryans, the people who carried on the Vedic tradition, they talk all about those catastrophes and a huge war, which is labeled the Mahabharata War, which is a gigantic war which destroyed most of the earth a long, long time ago and scattered the remnants of this once great culture all over Europe, the Germans and the Irish and the French, who were the Gauls at one time, and the Scandinavians were all part of this Vedic culture. Historians like to say that, you know, for some reason they've misconstrued Indian history and said that the Aryans invaded from Europe or down from the steppes of Russia, but that's actually not true. The Aryans were the people who ran India, the Vedic tradition. They colonized Europe later, and you can follow this by following the etymological trail. So you have a word like Scandinavia, and this is a Vedic word. Skanda is a god of ancient India, and Navia is a navy or navigation. And it was simply a colony that was founded by the navy followers of the god Skanda. And you can see this all through the languages, which is where I'm really fascinated by, is following this etymological trail. And when you do, you find that replete throughout the history of languages, these constant references to craft. Some are just small craft, round craft, lighted craft. Some are huge. I mean, like the size of a quarter the size of the moon, apparently, and they were called arks. And these were used to transport large groups of beings from one world to another to avoid cataclysms. And in fact, the Purana text says that every 60,000 years or so, the Aryans move off the planet and go to another planet to get away from a gigantic disaster. And they even named the planet, which is Mahar, which is very close to Mars.
Yeah, so, close enough for me, yeah.
Yeah, and Aryan actually translates directly from Aries, which means Mars. So, yeah, so Aryans are, and if you look at white people, you know, they have different variations, variegated eye color and hair color and and light skin and things, and this may have been accumulated while they stayed on Mars through vast areas of catastrophe here on Earth. And these texts are very explicit about this, in that they have they use ships which are powered by liquid mercury, which is spun in a vortex, which creates a huge electromagnetic field, which powers these craft. And we know that the German scientists were working on spinning mercury, as they were probably back engineering some of this stuff. And this is why the Germans were in North Africa and in Tibet and in the south of France, and in all the places where you would want to be if you were trying to find goodies buried under the earth that might help you back engineer some things. So this whole thing, you know, gets more and more interesting as you look at it. When you hear that story that we just heard tonight, you really realize that, wow, I wish I had been, you know, I was alive, I was born in 53, but I wish I had been born a little bit earlier and could have been conscious enough to track down a lot of this stuff before they bottled it up,
right?
Because we were, which was incredible. I mean, the things that were being discovered in that short time period really opened the door to the speculation that I'm allowed to do now. So, you know, we owe great credit to these people. We're standing on the shoulders of giants and people who courageously went forth and told us what we needed to hear. Especially, you know. Especially the guys who got really ramrodded, like one guy, what's his name? I forget his name now. The guy who was so critical of all the UFO government research, and they just put him away. And then the other guy
in New York?
Yeah, and then the guy that committed suicide. You know, this guy here that you had on tonight, you know, we're lucky that he's even still alive to tell
true.
The story.
I said it before, I'll say it again. I don't think we'll ever hear, we may never hear, I hope we do, but we may never hear an insider like that come forward at that high a level. Pentagon crash investigator comes forward. That's what it was.
I don't think we'll hear it. I really don't.
No, that's as amazing as
over.
It gets. Yeah.
I mean, you can dig up people from then, but you won't get anybody now to say anything.
No.
And, you know, so we can only go and do what you're doing, which is to go look back at what is happening. Now, even how did you find this guy? You know, so.
Yeah. Well, I hope he comes back on again, but I.
Well, yeah, we want to hear part two.
Oh, yeah. So do I. I just hope they don't mess with him. I think at this point in his life, he'd tell him to take a hike real quick.
Yeah. They won't go after him because they're too afraid to give credibility to any of us. That's
all
why
true.
They leave us alone. They think that if we just stay out here on the fringe, banging our crazy
drums. Well, we're like little kids throwing rocks in a huge lake. You know,
exactly.
Little pebbles. And as long as we just make little ripples in the water, they don't care. Wow. All right, back with Jay, and a few more minutes to go, right after this very short timeout. Okay, and back with Jay Widener. Jay, these crashes, the Woods have now logged, and they have the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas every year. They have logged, I think, it's getting on toward 100 now, over 80 different crash sites, crash locations, varying from a probability of 99, you know, down to maybe 50%. But there are an awful lot of them, and there are crashes we don't even know about, of course, and locations and stories, and I mean, you go from Roswell to Kecksburg to Cape Girardeau, and on and on. He knew about it. He was at Cape Girardeau. I can't even believe this. I mean, that just amazed me.
Yeah, well, you know, why are they crashing is the real question. He thinks it was radar. And
that's been proposed by other people. In 1948, we had a very high powerful radar in New Mexico we were experimenting with, and maybe it was intentional or accidental. Maybe they were using them as some kind of a beam weapon, or the idea was of a beam weapon, and they found that they could confuse these craft and bring them down. I don't know.
Actually, that may be very true, actually, or they may have been using a beam weapon without us knowing it and just saying it was radar.
That's right.
Yeah, that's because. I mean, the Tesla technology has been localized by then.
Yep.
So, they were bringing them down, and they must have got told eventually that they had to stop, because there hasn't been anything recent.
That dovetails perfectly into Frank Fascino's book, Shoot Them Down, which occurred during the summer of 1953-54, I guess, one of those 2 years, when the Air Force had a standing order to physically try to shoot them down. And the result was the loss of hundreds of jet fighter craft over the United States in those years, and hundreds of air crew. Some survived, some didn't. Frank's been on the program before, and that book, Shoot Them Down, is an amazing document. It describes the stupidity of the military.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no doubt. There's hundreds of stories of people chasing him from the military and the Air Force.
Right.
And lots of guys getting shot down.
Yep.
And then the clamp comes down, you know, and they fake it. They create the commission in Boulder, and they fake the whole thing. Like they're the Connie Commission, like they're really investigating it. They slam the whole thing shut, and at that point we were in a psychological dictatorship from which we have never escaped. And I think they decided to dumb us down so that we would quit asking these questions. And it's working.
Yeah. Absolutely is.
It is. The next step will be the health care, which will just finish us off. So.
Well, as you know, I haven't watched television for almost 22 years now. I see clips on YouTube and so forth. I won't watch it for reasons we've discussed. There are things going on there electromagnetically with embedded resonances and frequencies. It's not just what we're seeing and hearing. It's a mind control tool that is being used to absolutely disconnect us from our basic birthright of intellectual curiosity of the things around us. This teaching passivity, instructing it, inculcating it, forcing it into people's, these children's brains, passivity. No more proactive, it's all reactive. These are just drooling moron zombies walking around ready to be pounced upon by the very next advertising scam that causes them to start to salivate.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I didn't see this, but my wife saw it. Apparently the other day I was on NPR, or heard it on NPR, that in India the government is encouraging the citizens of India to quit worshiping their gods and believing in the healing ceremonies and things of their religion. And instead, literally, they're walking down the street, these people from the government injecting behavior modification drugs like Prozac into the people all over, like Bombay, Mumbai, or Calcutta.
Wow.
And thousands a day are being shot up right in the streets of India. They're not even cleaning the needles or anything, just injecting them. And this is behavior control.
Uh-huh.
And that's what's going on here. If you want to really know, it is television, but it's television coupled with behavioral drugs.
And that's really the dumbing down of America.
Well, fluoride, of course, leads the way.
Oh, fluorides. Oh, my
all
God.
Of them, all of the...
Calcify your, your synapses.
All the psychoactive drugs, if you read the ingredients, the SSRIs, you'll find the root word somewhere in there, F-L-U-O-R-O, fluoro, fluoro, fluoro. They're all these compounds of fluoride.
All done on purpose.
Of course.
Yep. Which is amazing because that was what General Jack D. Ripper and Dr. Strangelove started World War III on, because they were fluoridating the water. And Kubrick was in on it, you know, in 63.
He knew.
Yeah, and he says it's a communist plot. And there it was, you know.
And here we are.
In front of everyone. It was just being said, you know.
Yeah.
And it is. And it's designed. If you know what how fluoride works on the brain, it completely calcifies the whole brain. Turns into a pile of chalk.
First thing it does, it defeats the idea of territoriality and defensing your own perimeter. It's gone. It makes you completely compliant. They started using it at World War II POW camps, for you folks who don't know. And that's why it's in the water. That's why the city of Morgan Hill in California, for example, when the people voted not to fluoridate the water, the California Supreme Court overruled the vote of the citizens and ordered Morgan Hill to fluoridate.
Yes, there's no doubt. You know, there's very few cities or towns in the United States that don't have it. And, you know,
it's not easy to get out through home filtration systems either, friends. Don't kid yourself.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. And it's getting worse. And we're falling down into the Kali Yuga. We're in the final throes of really, I hate to say it, the twilight of our species. And we don't seem to be able to pull it out. And I guess according to the ancient texts, this is the way it's supposed to be. And everything reverses on itself. And I was thinking the other day, if there was a revolution in this country, which there won't be, but if there was, let's just say that everyone got up and grabbed a gun and marched off to City Hall and started demanding what they wanted and everything, the Chinese would just use that as an excuse to attack us. So I don't think we can win here.
No, I agree. No,
yeah.
Right now we serve the Chinese very well as a consuming sucker nation.
They'd like to get our land, though, I think.
Well, if they want it, they'll figure out a way to get it. They fight the long war. I'm curious to see how that whole Asian, it's almost a primordial way of doing business, but how that's going to interface when it comes to loggerheads with the Zionist ghouls who are running the Western show out of the city of London, how they're going to overcome that Asian. They're going to try and buy them off. I think they're in over their heads when it comes to the Asian mentality.
Well, you know, I hope so. Actually.
Yeah, I do too.
I don't know. You have to outthink a psychopath. You have to be a psychopath. That's the problem with psychopaths, is that you can't, unless you're one of them, you'll never outthink them. So I don't know if the Chinese are actually psychopathic. They don't appear to be that way. They don't seem to have a gigantic colonialist appetite, for instance, or anything.
Let's hope they're shrewd enough. But you see, that's the problem. That's how the masses are dominated, because they're still hung up on a quasi-normal bedrock of intellectual processes that the psychopaths...
It's not true.
The psychopaths laugh their asses off at this, to put it in the vernacular. Sorry. They just howl at the stupidity of people and how dumb they are.
True. Having had many interactions with psychopaths in the last 5 years, I can guarantee you that they're laughing their ass, at us, because we're like the guy getting conned. And then you're too embarrassed after you got conned to even tell anyone that you got conned. And they depend on you being too embarrassed. So you never reveal the psychopaths. And you're too embarrassed to say you got conned by them. And this may be the driving force behind people like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh never saying anything about who the real psychopaths are.
They never do.
Well, besides the fact that they're completely owned.
owned, paid, created, and put out there as diversionary icons, and that's all they are.
Oh, yeah. And you can bet your bottom dollar that if a revolution started tomorrow, both Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh would be flying off to Costa Rica, getting out of here as fast as possible.
That's right. Well, Ted Turner, among others, has a plane on standby 24 hours a day.
A lot of them do. I know a couple of them.
They're ready to go. A lot of them are ready to go, and they own land down south. They're 6 hours away from leading an idyllic life while the rest of this northern hemisphere goes up in flames.
Well, we are going to go up. We're facing, you know, a very generational, the fourth turning of a revolutionary event here, it's going to be one of fury and anger because of the deep divisions in American society. And it's going to be very entertaining.
Well, divide and rule has been taken to its maximum now. It's polarizing people to the extent now that we're back to the Civil War again. Brother will kill brother, sister will kill sister. They want that. That's where they're pushing it.
They do, just as the British wanted that to happen in our Civil War.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah, it's the same. Now, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
That's right.
Amazing. Jay, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Jay, for being on, Jeff. Thanks so much for your great work. You're a great patriot.
Thank you, sir. Good night. And thanks to all of you for being here. What an amazing evening. We'll be putting this up for a worldwide free listen at Rents.com very shortly. All right. Again, you matter. And we are very grateful for your support. Talk to you in 21 minutes.